Okay, so it's a pleasure today to have as our seminar speaker Alexander Wills, and the title of the talk is Three Ways to Classicalize Nearly Any Probabilistic Theory. And yeah, the floor is yours.
Thank you. All right, so thanks very much for the invitation, which has allowed me to sort of, well, revisit some things that I was thinking about maybe a year or so ago. So I'll talk about three ways to you know, sort of it's the opposite of quantizing. I'm going to talk about three ways to classicalize, maybe not quite any conceivable probabilistic theory, but a whole lot of them. And so let me just dive right in. Here's a slogan that's something of a commonplace. You hear this a lot. That quantum mechanics is a non-classical probability theory. There's certainly a lot that's right about this, but I think it's also important to bear in mind a couple of caveats. The first one is that there's a distinction to be made between a probability theory and a probabilistic theory. A probabilistic theory is presumably, a theory that you've developed to model some particular situation in which probabilities enter. A probability theory should be a general doctrine of chances, some sort of general theory about how you reason in the face of uncertainty. I'm not entirely sure it even makes sense to talk about a non-classical probability theory. I sort of think there's only one probability theory, and that's whatever our currently most general theory is about how you reason about uncertainty. And one way of thinking about that is that it should be the theory of probabilistic theories, thought of as just sort of, you know, individual instantiations of that. So that's one caveat. I'd prefer to say quantum mechanics is a probabilistic theory. The other caveat is that the word classical, even as applied to individual probabilistic theories, is a little bit treacherous. I think the boundary between what we call classical and non-classical probabilistic theories is actually a little bit blurry and maybe even in some measure conventional. And to explore that idea, I want to present, and in some cases this means review, three ways of interpreting a what we would now call a GPT, a general probabilistic theory, in terms of classical probability theory. And in descending order of familiarity, these are a generalization of the fairly familiar Beltrametti-Bugaisky style of representation. Then a considerably simpler but probably much less familiar representation involving what I call the semi-classical cover of a probabilistic model. This we could call the semi-classical extension, perhaps. And then finally, a representation not for arbitrary GPTs, but only for those that have a lot of symmetry, in which the probabilistic structure is actually just completely and manifestly classical, but the sort of non-classical aspect is shifted into the dynamics. This reminds me a little bit, at least in spirit, of Bohmian mechanics, although the analogy may be kind of strained. I'd be interested to know what people think about that. This is based on the paper. I guess the link was distributed. I'll refer to this if I need to refer to it as AW 2020. That's the year it appeared. I don't know why I haven't put this on the archive yet, but one of these days I will. So here's the plan of the talk. I'm going to start by reviewing GPTs because the mathematical framework that I use is a little different from the one that most people are probably used to. I think it's actually more flexible. So I'll start by telling you what I think a probabilistic model is, and then we'll talk a little bit about probabilistic theories, which for me are categories of probabilistic models. And then I'll talk about one way that you might attempt to interpret a GPT in classical terms using what we can call classical embeddings. But as we'll see, Those don't usually exist. So that route is blocked in general. So then we'll talk about a different approach to representing things classically. This is the sort of Bugaisky, Beltrametti style approach, classical extensions. Then I'll talk about the semi-classical extension and then about these, as I call them, dynamical classical representations. And if we have time, and we might decide we don't want to have time, but if we have time, we'll talk about composite systems as well. Okay, so let's talk about GPTs. And let's actually start by thinking about classical probability theory in its most naive formulation, the formulation that you give students in, you know, college freshmen in Stat 101, in which you tell them that a probabilistic model is a structure that consists of a discrete set, capital E, which we think of as the set of outcomes of some experiment, which might be tossing a coin a certain number of times or rolling a die. And then additionally, you have a probability weight on E, you know, a discrete probability measure on E. So that's the usual usage of the term probabilistic model. But there are at least two ways in which you might want to generalize this. One is to consider not just a single probability weight, but many. And the other is to allow for multiple outcome sets, because you aren't always dealing with just a single measurement or a single experiment. Now, let's actually start by thinking about how to generalize E here, the single outcome set of classical probability theory. Well, there's an easy way to generalize that. Consider a set of outcome sets. So that's what we will call a test space. A test space is a collection of sets interpreted as outcome sets of possible experiments, or as we'll call them, tests. And mathematically, that's just a hypergraph, right? Just a set of, well, a non-empty set of non-empty sets. I should have said they should be non-empty. The idea of thinking of a hypergraph that way, thinking of a collection of discrete classical sample spaces, outcome spaces, goes back a long way. It was actually developed in some detail by C.H. Randall and D.J. Faulis in the 70s and 80s. And by way of full disclosure, Faulis was my PhD advisor. So I've kind of inherited this framework from them. Also, in some of the more recent literature, these things are called contextuality scenarios. So some of you might be familiar with them in that guise. I much prefer the term test space, which I think is a little bit more transparent. Okay, so suppose you have a test space, fancy M here. If you take the union of all of the outcome sets in big M, you get a big set X, which consists of all of the outcomes of all of the experiments that you're considering. I'll call that the total outcome space. And that lets you define a probability weight on the test space. A probability weight, alpha generically, is a mapping from the total outcome space to the unit interval, assigning probabilities to outcomes such that those probabilities add up to one over each of the tests in your collection, right? Each set in the collection big M is the outcome space of an experiment. So the probabilities need to add up to one on that outcome set. I'll write PR of M for the set of all these probability weights. Now this set, let me talk about the set in a moment. One crucial thing to notice is that I haven't said anything about the combinatorial structure of the hypergraph. The sets in big M are allowed to overlap. You're permitted to say that a particular outcome is equally an outcome of experiment E and an outcome of experiment F, perfectly allowed, and it's more general to allow it. So let's go ahead and do so. When tests overlap, the probabilities assigned by a probability weight to a particular outcome don't depend on which test you're performing. Presumably, if they did, you shouldn't have identified that outcome between those two tests. So probability weights are non-contextual. They have non-contextuality baked into their definition. The set of probability weights is pretty evidently convex as a subset of the space of functions from X into the unit interval. And if the tests are all finite, then it's pointwise closed and therefore compact in the product topology. And one of the nice things about test spaces is that they are so sort of loosely defined that they're easy to manipulate, and in particular, they're easy to add structure to. So you can add further structure if you need it very easily in general. So now we've got a natural generalization of the naive received idea of a probabilistic model, one experiment, one probability weight. Instead, we consider a test space, many outcome sets, and I don't necessarily want to insist that we consider all the probability weights, but we should be willing to identify some subset of the set of probability weights and single them out for study. And so the other part of a probabilistic model is a set of probability weights that you've distinguished for some reason, which I'll call the state space of the model, and the elements thereof are the states of the model. So states are probability weights, but maybe you don't want to consider every probability weight a legitimate state. So you have a lot of flexibility in how you set this up, depending on what you're trying to model. This idea also is very old. If you go back and you look at Mackey's work, even his 1957 article that preceded his book, in effect, he's talking about a probabilistic model in which all the tests have just two outcomes, yes and no, effectively. He calls them questions. Fowlis and Randall also considered pairs like this, and they called them by the much, much cooler name stochastic entities, which is just lovely, but I'm gonna stick with probabilistic model because again, I think it's more transparent. Okay, so since that was maybe a little abstract in some sense, let's look at a toy example, kind of visual. Here's a famous toy test space. Some of you have seen this before. The outcomes are the nodes in this triangular graph here. And the tests are the sets of nodes along each of the three sides. So there are three tests. There's a blue test, a red test, and a green test, each with three outcomes, and they share outcomes. The corner outcomes are each shared between two tests. So here are some examples of probability weights. We can make a sort of deterministic probability weight this way. We might decide that this lower left corner outcome should have probability one. If that's the case, then the probabilities of the other two outcomes in this bottom test have to be zero. And similarly, the probabilities of these two outcomes in the blue test also have to be zero. But now these two other corner outcomes are both zero. So the only option for the middle outcome in the green test is that it's got probability one as well. And you can see that there are several other possibilities. You can basically make any of the corner outcomes one and the opposite node one, or you can make all three of the middle outcomes one. Those are the deterministic probability weights. There are also some interesting non-deterministic probability weights. In particular, this one, if I give the corner nodes probabilities of a half, those probabilities add up to one over each test, over each side of the triangle. So that's a bona fide probability weight. If you look at the convex structure of the set of states for this thing, the set of probability weights for this thing rather, you actually find that unsurprisingly, the deterministic probability weights are extreme or pure, but so is this one. This one is also pure. So there's kind of interesting things that go on even in a toy example like this. Let me just pause for a moment and ask if there are any questions at this point. Is everybody reasonably happy with how this works? Okay, so let's look at some non-toy examples. Of course, the thing we started with, where you had big E and a single probability weight, that would be an example. We could also consider a single test and all of the probability weights on that test. That's sort of a simple classical probabilistic model. As you see, I'm using delta of E as the notation for the set of probability weights on a discrete set. But we can also do sort of full-blown measure theoretic Kolmogorovian probability theory this way. If you've got a measurable space S, let's let fancy D of S be the set of all finite measurable partitions of S by measurable sets. Then every probability weight in the simplex of probability measures on S defines a probability weight on this test space. And so you can use that pair as a probabilistic model. So this is not less general than conventional Kolmogorovian probability theory. It encompasses that as a special case. Going forward, when I want to look at models of this sort of Kolmogorovian type, I'm just going to write DS for the entire model and not write the whole pair. But I have in mind that you're using all the probability weights as the state space. Okay, a simple example of a quantum model, not the only one, but a simple one, is to start with a Hilbert space H, maybe finite dimensional, although actually I don't really need that. I don't know why I put that in. You can take for your test space the set of all orthonormal bases for H, in which case the total outcome space is going to be the unit sphere. You can let the state space be, well, the state space. You can let it be, for instance, all the probability weights arising from density operators, according to the Born rule. Which, according to Gleason's, oops, I'm going ahead of myself. I guess I took something out. According to Gleason's theorem, that would be all the probability weights if the dimension of H is bigger than two. Or we could go in a different direction. There wouldn't be anything to prohibit us from taking omega to be, you know, all the pure states. You have a lot of choices you can make. Okay, so here's a construction I'm going to want to use later on. And this sort of makes some contact with the more familiar framework for GPTs, in which you just start with an abstract convex set as your state space. So let's do that. Let's suppose we've got a convex set K that we're thinking of as a state space. As everybody here will know, an effect on K is an affine functional from K into the unit interval. And the unit effect is the particular functional that takes every element of K to one. We're going to write the set of effects using this closed interval notation. All the effects are, the effect set of effects is ordered, and they do lie between zero and the unit effect. It's standard to define a discrete observable over this convex set, this abstract state space K, to be a finitely indexed collection, little a sub I, of effects, of non-zero effects, just to avoid nonsense, that sum to the unit effect. That lets you interpret elements of K as probability assignments, because if I evaluate this, if I evaluate all these effects at a particular point of K and interpret the result as the probability of effect A in the state represented by that point, this tells you that those probabilities add up to one over the observable. Now, we can actually turn this into a probabilistic model in my sense as follows. Let's let fancy M think of this little o here as either meaning ordered or observables. I don't know how you prefer to read it. Anyway, MO of K is the set of graphs of observables indexed by finite sets of natural numbers. So the outcome set for that test space is going to be the natural numbers cross the interval from zero to the unit effect. If you have a state, if you have a point in the convex set, you turn it into a state, a probability weight rather, on this test space by defining, if the point's name is alpha, you define alpha zero, or alpha O rather, of the ordered pair IA, just to be the effect A evaluated at the point alpha. And then you get probabilities adding up to one over all of the tests. So that gives you a model whose state space is just the set of probability weights arising from points of K in this way. That's affinely isomorphic to K. So in effect, you've got a model whose state space is K in a standard way. I'm just going to write MOK for the entire model and just leave it as understood that we're using that state space. Okay, so this framework is also not less general than the usual notion of GPTs. Okay, so if we want to talk not about individual probabilistic models, but probabilistic theories, then we need to have appropriate morphisms between models. There are actually a lot of ways you can define morphisms between models, but the one I'm going to use today, which is general enough, works like this. Let's agree that an event for a model A is a subset of a test, just as in ordinary probability theory. Any set of outcomes that are contained in the outcome set of some measurement qualifies as an event. I'm going to write fancy E of A for the set of events. If alpha is a state and little a here, it's not an effect, it's a set of outcomes, is an event, then I can assign a probability to that event in the usual way, just add up the probabilities of the outcomes in the event. And now an interpretation from A to B. This is a notion that goes back to a paper of Fowlis and Randall in 1978, I believe, is a mapping from outcomes of A, possibly not to outcomes, but possibly to events of B. You might take an outcome and interpret it as a whole event of B, such that these two things are true. First of all, if you take a test belonging to the model A, the image of that test under phi, the set of events associated to its outcomes by phi, is a partition of a test in B. In other words, it's a pairwise disjoint set of events that union up to a test in B, a kind of a coarse-grained version of a test in B. So tests in A go to coarse-grained, possibly coarse-grained versions of tests in B. And further, I want it to be the case that if I start with a state of B and I define phi star, calling it beta, if I define phi star of beta to be the function of an outcome X of A that is just beta evaluated at phi of X, that which is manifestly going to be a probability weight on A should actually be one of the allowed states of A. So tests push forward to coarse-grained tests and states of B pull back to states of A. That turns out to be a very serviceable notion. It covers a lot of ground. And moreover, interpretations compose. One way to think about an interpretation is because it's a set-valued mapping, it can be thought of as a relation. These things compose as relations. Here's the recipe for composition. And this gives us a category, any subcategory of which I think I would be willing to call a probabilistic theory. Here are some examples of interpretations. If we start with two measurable spaces, S and T, and a measurable function from one to the other, then let's define an associated interpretation phi from the Kolmogorovian model associated with T back to the Kolmogorovian model associated with S. This is going to be kind of a contravariant construction. I'll define phi of a measurable set B, a measurable subset of T, to be its pre-image. I have to put, kind of annoyingly, I have to put set braces around that because it's supposed to be an event of D of T, and D of T already consists of sets. So it's that, you know, the singleton corresponding to that pre-image event, if that's non-empty, and it's the empty event if F inverse of B is empty. I can do something similar in a much more general context. If K1 and K2 are compact convex sets, and F is an affine mapping from K1 to K2, actually they don't even have to be compact, then I'll define phi from the test space corresponding to the observables on K back to the one corresponding to the observables on K2, back to the one corresponding to the observables on K1 as follows. I'm going to say phi applied to an outcome of this test space, which is an ordered pair I followed by an effect on K2. That's going to be the singleton event corresponding to I, comma, the effect B composed with F, which is an effect on K1, if that effect is not zero, and I'll set it equal to the empty event if that effect is zero. And I'm sort of leaving it to you to trust me that those actually are interpretations of models, not just of test spaces, that states pull back appropriately to states, which they do. Okay, now in some cases, you find that when you evaluate your interpretation at an outcome X, you always get an event, but the event is just a singleton event, an event consisting of a single outcome. Never the empty event, always just a particular outcome, maybe in curly braces. In that case, you can forget the curly braces and just treat your interpretation as a certain kind of mapping from outcomes to outcomes. And if that's the case, and moreover, that mapping is injective, so distinct outcomes go to distinct outcomes, and if the sort of dual mapping that pulls states of B back to states of A is surjective, so every state on A sort of arises from a state on B, or it can be interpreted in terms of a state on B, in that case, I'm going to say that I have an embedding of the model A into the model B. So we can ask this question: when does an abstract probabilistic model A admit a classical embedding, that is an embedding into one of these Kolmogorovian probabilistic models, in which you start with a measurable space, you look at all the measurable partitions for your test space and all the probability measures for the state space? Well, that actually has a very clean answer. Excuse me, I'm getting a little hoarse, so I'm gonna have a sip of tea. To tell you the answer, I need a little bit of terminology. Let's say that a probability weight on A, or on the test space of A, is dispersion free if it only takes the values 0 and 1. So deterministic would be another perfectly good term for this, on every outcome. let's let S of A stand for the set of all these deterministic or dispersion-free probability weights on A. Incidentally, there might not be any, but in which case S of A would be the empty set. But let's let S of A be the set of all the dispersion-free probability weights. I'm going to say that the model A is unitally dispersion-free, or UDF for a shorthand, if it has two properties. First, that every outcome of A has probability 1 with respect to some deterministic or dispersion-free probability weight. And secondly, that the designated set of states, the set of probability weights you've singled out as the actual states of your system, should be contained in the closed convex hull of S of A, so that every state arises as the limit of an average of dispersion-free states. And the theorem, of which you can find all sorts of versions in the literature, is that a model admits a classical embedding if and only if it's UDF. And if it is UDF, you can take the measurable space S to be the set of dispersion-free states. So that's great, gives us a clean answer, but it's also a limiting answer. For one thing, this condition that every state be an average of dispersion-free states for the model to be UDF, rules out a lot. So for example, if you go back to that triangle example, it's got lots of DF states, but this 1/2, 1/2, 1/2 probability weight isn't one of them. It's extreme, so it isn't an average of them. And so if you tried to build a probabilistic model with the triangle test space as your test space, and with this state as one of, or this probability weight as one of your states, you won't be able to model it classically at all. Of course, in some cases, you don't have any dispersion-free states to begin with, in which case it doesn't matter how you choose your state space. There's no classical interpretation, no classical embedding. That's the case for quantum models, thanks to Gleason's theorem, at least if the dimension of the Hilbert space is bigger than 2. So what to do? Well, one thing that people realized quite a long time ago is that you can sort of put aside for a moment the idea that you need to look at embeddings and just think about the state space for a moment. Part of my definition of an embedding was that the mapping phi star was a surjection from states of B to states of A. Maybe we should focus on that. In general, you know, in mathematics, if you want to explain one object in terms of another, embeddings aren't the only thing you can look at. You can also look at taking quotients. As a very simple example of this, one way of representing a square, or a rectangle maybe, I should say, is as the shadow cast by a tetrahedron on the plane, if the tetrahedron is oriented correctly. So there's a certain sense in which, you know, the square, which as a convex state space is non-classical because it's not a simplex, can be explained in terms of something classical. The tetrahedron is a simplex, that's a classical state space. So getting this kind of thing to work in infinite dimensions is the subject of a whole field called Choquet theory. And I'll just give you a tiny sample result that's enough for our purposes. If you have a compact convex set, I do need K to be compact here, sitting inside, say, some locally convex topological vector space V, let's let delta zero of K be the set of bare probability measures on K, or equivalently the Radon probability measures, the ones that arise as linear functionals, positive normalized linear functionals on the ring of continuous functions on continuous real valued functions on K. This is a kind of infinite dimensional simplex. And we're going to see that K is a quotient of this. If you take a bare probability measure on K, you define its barycenter. If the measure is called mu, I'll call the barycenter mu hat. This way, if you start with a linear functional in the dual, a bounded linear function, well, a continuous linear functional in the dual V star of this ambient vector space V, you define mu hat to be the functional taking F to the integral of F over the convex set K with respect to mu. It's what's called a weak integral. And that you can show always exists. A priori, it defines an element of the dual of V's dual. However, you can actually prove using compactness that, that this barycenter actually always defines a point in K. So you've got a mapping, the mapping taking mu to its barycenter that goes from delta zero of K to K. And it's very easy to argue that every element of K is the barycenter of at least one probability measure, like a point mass maybe. So this mapping is surjective. So every compact convex set is the shadow of a simplex. It's the quotient of a simplex. And you can do this in other ways as well. This isn't necessarily the best theorem of this type. There are stronger theorems in which case in which you can look at the you can replace the K here by the set of extreme points of K and so on. But I won't need that, those results, so let me just move on. That last result suggests the following definition. Maybe we should say that a classical extension of a probabilistic model A with its state space omega V is just some affine surjection from the set of probability measures on some measurable space onto the state space omega V. Now, that people have looked at that for a long time in various contexts. It's a fruitful idea. Notice that it doesn't seem to make any reference to the test space structure on A. However, this surjection, if we have it, can be dualized to give us a mapping from outcomes to effects on this compact convex set of probability measures as follows. Calling this dual mapping Q star of an outcome X applied to the probability measure mu is just the state Q of mu, the image of mu under Q, which is a state on A evaluated at X. This turns out to be an interpretation from A into the test space associated with the observables on the convex set delta of S. And as long as the state space you started with is big enough to separate outcomes so that different outcomes have different probabilities, at least in some state, it's actually an embedding. Now, there's an old and fairly familiar story about effects on the simplex of probability measures on a measurable space S, according to which they should be thought of as unsharp or perhaps fuzzy or noisy analogs of the indicator functions of subsets of S. So that tests in this big test space associated with the observables on delta of S can be thought of as unsharp or fuzzy or noisy versions of partitions. In other words, Q star looks like an unsharp version of the classical embeddings that we saw didn't exist in general. But these unsharp versions do exist in general. So, in fact, this construction is kind of canonical, right? You start with omega of A, you take for S the convex set omega of A itself, in cases where it's compact, I should have said, though I did say it's compact, with its bare field. And then you get this classical extension slash fuzzy classical embedding. And this construction is even functorial in the sense that that passing from a probabilistic model A to this construction, this model here, is actually a contravariant functor. This is the object part of a contravariant functor from probabilistic models and interpretations from the category int, in other words, or that subcategory where the state spaces are compact convex sets, to these unsharp Kolmogorovian models. Okay, so that's great as long as we are content with that sort of unsharp version of classical probability theory, but not everybody is going to be. I'm not sure that I am. So here's a way in which we can maybe do a little bit better with actually a lot less work. Taking a test E in your test space, let me let E tilde be the set of, let's call them labeled outcomes, outcomes in which you add a record of which test you perform. Let's let big M tilde be the set of all of these labeled tests, or the set of all the outcomes of these labeled versions of these tests. The outcome set of that is just the set of labeled outcomes for all the various tests. Every probability weight on omega of A defines a probability weight on this thing just by forgetting the record of which test you perform and evaluating the original probability weight. And so now you have a model in which, in effect, what you've done is to take all of the original tests which might have overlapped and you've pulled them apart so they no longer overlap. Is everybody clear with that? That if I have a record of which test I performed, then the tests can no longer share outcomes? Yes? Okay, because the labels will be different. This is called the semi-classical cover of A. There's actually an interpretation from this sort of disjointified, pulled apart version of A back to A. The word semi-classical, because the jargon is that any test space in which the tests don't actually overlap is semi-classical. It's not very hard to show that tilde is UDF. It's unitally dispersion free. So it has a classical embedding. And so you can represent A as a quotient of a submodel of one of these, of a classical model with no fuzziness involved. This construction is also functorial. Here's the recipe for boosting an interpretation from A to B to an interpretation from A twiddle to A to B twiddle. So we have a covariant functor, which on objects takes model A to the actual Kolmogorovian test space associated with, or model associated with, the set of dispersion-free states, not on A, but on this disjointified semi-classical version. So here's a diagrammatic picture of what we've done. We've seen that sharp classical embeddings don't usually exist. Unsharp classical embeddings do usually exist, but you can also represent A in sort of two steps as a quotient of a model that has a strict classical embedding, which I think is perhaps even a little bit nicer. Okay, so all of that's, you know, fairly either familiar or straightforward. There's one more approach that I want to talk about. I realize that I've been talking for a long time, but I'm going to forge ahead if I may. Maybe I can stop just briefly. Are there any questions at this point? Maybe a quick one. I ask partly so that I can have more tea.
I have a question, just a kind of clarification one. Mm-hmm. It was, you said a few slides ago about an extension being an embedding when omega A, so mm-hmm. the states separate the outcomes. So presumably you mean the outcomes of S.
No, right? I mean the outcomes in the model. So the elements in X of A. Okay. So if I have enough states, so that if I have two distinct outcomes, I can distinguish them by saying, you know, this one has probability, you know, one half in a given state, and this one has probability a third. So they're not the same. As long as there are enough states so that distinct outcomes don't always get the same probability in every state. Does that answer the question?
Yes, I guess. Yeah, like, okay, maybe I'm like, I thought outcomes were always separated by states.
It's a standard assumption that people make, but I haven't felt compelled to make it.
Okay.
And actually, there are some cases in which you don't, like in quantum mechanics, if you're thinking of outcomes as unit vectors, two unit vectors that differ by a phase are different unit vectors, but they have the same probability in every state. Mm-hmm. Now, you might want to say, oh, just identify them, use rank one projections, but maybe you don't. I'm willing to be generous about that. I don't want to allow sort of maximal flexibility in the modeling of things. Okay, here's one more way of representing things classically. This doesn't apply in as much generality as the last two, but it still applies pretty widely. I want to consider probabilistic models that have an additional dynamical structure. By this, I mean I'm going to single out a group, I'll call it G of A, if A is the name of the model, of interpretations from A to itself. Outcome preserving means outcomes go to single outcomes, not bigger events. Positive means nothing goes to the empty event. But that's equivalent to saying it's a group of bijections from the outcome set of A to itself. So these group elements permute, I guess I've said this redundantly here, they permute the outcomes. I want them also to permute the tests. So the set of tests should be invariant under the action of this group. The image of a test under one of the group elements is another test. And also the states should be invariant under the usual right action on functions on X. So if G is a group element acting on outcomes, I can compose that with a state to get a new probability weight. I want that also to be one of the designated states. So I'm going to call any model equipped with a group in this way, group action in this way, a dynamical probabilistic model, or just a dynamical model for short. And the term dynamical, I think, is well chosen because in cases where G of A is a Lie group, we can then model a reversible dynamics for A by choosing a continuous one-parameter subgroup of this dynamical group, tracking the system's evolution over time. We start with an initial state alpha zero, and evolve the system through time t by g sub t, then we get alpha composed with, usually it would be g sub minus t, because if we're evolving the outcomes forward in time, we would need to evolve the states backward in time to accomplish the same thing. The assumption, I want to mention this because I'm going to come back to it, the assumption that the one parameter group is actually a group homomorphism, that it, in other words, that evolving the system through t plus units of time is the same as evolving it through s units and then through t units of time. That encodes a kind of a Markovian assumption about the dynamics, that the system's later state only depends on its initial state and the amount of elapsed time, and not on the whole system, not on the whole history of the system. Okay, I like to call a dynamical model symmetric if the dynamical group acts transitively on the test. So every test looks like every other test up to the action of the group. Any test can be mapped to any other. And also if the stabilizer of any particular test and therefore of any test acts transitively on the outcome set for that test. So that within every test, every outcome looks the same as every other under actions of this dynamical group that fix that test. This is all true of the quantum probabilistic model because here you would take the dynamical group to be the unitary group, and I can certainly map any orthonormal basis to any other orthonormal basis, and I can permute the elements of any fixed orthonormal basis at will by unitaries that are diagonal in that basis. So now I want to consider the following story, which I claim is completely classical. Suppose you've got some sort of piece of laboratory apparatus that implements a single experiment. It's got a fixed outcome set, call it E. And I want you to imagine you've also got some physical system with a state space omega governed maybe by a Lie group G, which I'll take to act on the right of omega. And suppose the two are coupled probabilistically. The experiment is coupled to the physical system by a probabilistic coupling given by a function that assigns to a state alpha and an outcome X of this one fixed experiment E, a probability, adding up to one over all of the outcomes. Simple as that. Of course, this function P is just a Markov kernel, a discrete Markov kernel, right? A function of two variables that takes values in the unit interval and acts like a probability weight on the second, in the second variable for fixed values in the first. There's nothing non-classical here. Markov kernels are part of the standard apparatus of classical probability theory. Now, I want to make a couple of, I think, reasonably benign assumptions. I want to assume that the states are sufficiently numerous to separate the outcomes in E. If I have two states that have the same probability, two outcomes that have the same probability in every state of the system, then they're actually the same outcome. If not, factor out the obvious equivalence relation on E. I also want to assume that the measurement, the classical measurement E you're making, together with the group of symmetries of the system are enough to separate states. In other words, if I have two states alpha and beta, or a state alpha and a state beta, and if after evolving the state by group element G and then measuring the system, measuring the you know, performing the measurement given by my apparatus, I get the same probability distribution regardless of G, then the states must have been the same to begin with. So E has to be, E and G together have to be robust enough to describe the state space completely. If not, factor out the obvious equivalence relation on the states. Okay, so with this setup, notice that every state can also be interpreted in either of these two ways. I'm going to use the same notation because I don't really care which one we use. They're obviously equivalent. I could think of the state as giving me a function, which I'll call alpha hat, from the group to the set of probability weights on the apparatus just by this recipe. Alpha hat of G is the probability weight whose value at X is just, is just the probability of alpha G at comma X. Or I could think of alpha hat as a Markov kernel, a function from G cross E to the unit interval given by the same recipe. I don't really care, take your pick. Either way, we've got something relatively classical, either maybe sort of a random probability weight on E indexed by the group or a Markov kernel like this. Either way, I'm gonna call alpha hat the dynamical state associated with the physical state alpha. My state assumption, state separation assumption tells me that the mapping from alpha to alpha hat is injective, so I can identify alpha with alpha hat. Now, you can say that an element of the physical symmetry group G implements a permutation of the outcomes of your apparatus if for every state alpha, P alpha G comma X, the probability of X in the state alpha G is the same thing as the probability of sigma X in the state alpha. By that second state separation condition, the first one, but it was equation two, if G implements a permutation at all, it only implements one, so I can call it sigma sub G. And then you can show that this set of physical symmetries that implement permutations is a subgroup of the physical symmetry group, and the mapping from this, which we'll call H, the mapping from H to the symmetric group on E given by G goes to sigma sub G as a homomorphism. In other words, the set E carries a natural action by H. I'm going to simplify notation henceforward and just write little hx instead of sigma sub hx if little h is one of the physical symmetries that implements a permutation. Now, it's natural to consider cases in which the apparatus's outcome set is transitive under this H action, so that every outcome looks like every other outcome under some symmetry that fixes the or permutes the set of outcomes. And that motivates a more abstract definition. I'm going to call a dynamical classical model a structure consisting of two groups, a big group and a subgroup, G and H respectively, a right G set omega, which I think of as a physical state space, and a transitive left H set E, which I think of as an outcome set for some experiment performed on the system. And finally, a Markov kernel linking the two that gives me the probability of outcome X in state alpha, satisfying my separation conditions and this covariance condition. I want the probability of seeing outcome HX in state alpha to be the same thing as the probability of seeing X in state alpha H. I can move H from one side to the other of this Markov, this basic Markov kernel P. Now, I want to stress that nothing I just described takes us outside the range of classical probability theory, right? I've got a Markov kernel, that's all, and some covariance conditions. But any symmetric probabilistic model, including finite dimensional quantum mechanics, for example, gives you an example of exactly this scenario. Just pick your favorite test in the test space as a sort of reference test, define P alpha X to be alpha of X, where alpha ranges over the probability, over the states of the model. So omega is omega of A, alpha hat of G of X is just alpha of GX, and so on. Conversely, and this is perhaps mathematically more interesting, you can take a dynamical classical model and use it to build a quote unquote non-classical symmetric probabilistic model with dynamical group equal to the given physical symmetry group and containing the apparatus outcome set as a test. I'm not going to get into the recipe right here because I realize I'm already possibly over time, but I've put it on the last slide, which people can see if they're interested in it. I probably won't read it. So the moral is that you can convert a dynamical classical model into a symmetric probabilistic model, actually in various ways parameterized by, I haven't told you what K is, never mind, that's on the last slide. You can classify the ways of doing this. So it seems that there's not a whole lot of difference between a non-classical symmetric probabilistic model and an essentially classical DCM. And you have to wonder, okay, you know, have I done something wrong? Can this possibly be right? Well, yes and no. I mean, it's right mathematically, but there is a little more going on. If you start with a state in the physical state space of your dynamic classical model, and you specify a dynamics, a one parameter subgroup of G, where G, I'm assuming here, is a Lie group, then you get a path, a trajectory in the space of probability weights on the single experiment that you're allowed to perform, right? Just by this recipe here. So dynamical states specify how the probabilities change over time, given any choice of dynamics for your system. However, these paths in delta V are not governed by flows. That is, there's no one parameter group of affine update maps from delta E to delta E that tells you how the states evolve. Another way to say that is that the observed evolution of probabilities of outcomes of the one measurement you're allowed to make don't look Markov at all. So the observed evolution looks in that way kind of non-classical. So it's the dynamical rather than the probabilistic structure I'm suggesting that might register as non-classical in this representation. Okay, let me pause for a moment. I did sort of offer the next section as something we could talk about if there was time, but it's now 2:58 and I wanna leave some time for questions. So let me ask people, is there appetite for me to talk about composite systems? This is two slides worth of material. Or should we just break and talk about questions at this point?
One of my questions was going to be about composite systems. So I would vote for the two slides, but okay. I also, yeah, if other people would rather discuss.
So I've got a fever and the only cure is composite systems.
Okay. Okay, well, let's go on. So in view of everything I've said, you know, you might want to ask, okay, does this mean quantum mechanics is classical after all? Well, of course not. I mean, right, there's a standard answer to that challenge, which is no, because non-locality or because entanglement. Right, okay, we all know how this goes. So let's just briefly consider how the three classical representations that we've just been discussing sort of, you know, run afoul of issues of non-locality. So because I knew I would be pressed for time, I cut out ruthlessly all the slides in which I define composites of various things. Let me just say, there is a standard definition of what it means for a model to be AB to be a composite of two probabilistic models, A and B. It's a pretty general definition. It doesn't require, this is actually kind of important, it doesn't require that the composite model be locally tomographic. In general, unless you put very stringent conditions on A and B, which basically require them to be classical, or at least one of them to be classical, in general, you'll be able to choose state spaces that will contain entangled states, or what you might prefer to call non-local states, states that aren't mixtures of product states. because we're not requiring local tomography, this is a point that I think maybe could be better disseminated or more widely disseminated. Because we're not requiring local tomography, or because I generally don't, you can actually have non-local states even if the two composites are classical, right? If you have two simplices and you want to make a composite that's another big simplex, if you're not required to make the big simplex somehow the Cartesian product of the two little simplices, if it can be much bigger than that, well, then it's going to contain lots of states that aren't averages of product states, and you probably have to call those non-local. And in fact, this is exactly what happens with the classical and the semi-classical extensions. You build very big simplices, but the simplex corresponding to a composite in general will be much, much bigger than the product of the simplices corresponding to the two factors. So the classical explanations are classical but non-local. I guess I'd want to say that passing from a non-classical probabilistic theory to its classical or semi-classical extension in this way, you know, doesn't somehow destroy the classicality of the probabilistic structure that you've used to interpret the models. It shifts the non-classicality from the probabilistic structure to the physics. I think non-locality is an issue of physics, not of probability theory. Okay, composites of dynamical classical models are much more interesting. You can write down a plausible definition for what such a composite should be. You can see the paper. One assumption that I think is natural is that if you have two DCMs and you want to compose them, each one has a preferred measurement, a single measurement you're allowed to make. Well, the measurement for the composite should be the product of the measurements. In general, the physical state space of the composite will certainly contain entangled states. If we're assuming things are convex. But a question arises, how would we detect them, right? We've only got the single classical measurement, EA cross EB. That's not enough to detect entanglement. Well, one thing you could do is you could reinterpret, AB and this C should be AB, sorry. You could reinterpret all the dynamical classical models in the story as symmetric probabilistic models according to the recipe that I declined to show you earlier. And then you take composites of these in the GPT way, and you've got enough tests to detect entangled states. But I wonder if there might be a more direct story to tell about this in terms of the dynamics. I wonder if there's some way to detect the existence of entanglement in terms of how the dynamics of the composite behaves. So I'll leave with that question, plus a few further kind of questions and further projects. One question I have has to do with contextuality. There's a sense in which classical extensions are preparation contextual. There's a sense in which the semi-classical extensions are measurement contextual. I want to know in what way are DCMs contextual. Maybe somebody who understands contextuality better can answer this. Here's another question. If we have CDM should be DCM, I guess, unless classicality and dynamics commute. If you have a CDM, a DCM with a G Li group, I guess there should be an H in here somewhere. I want to know how an element of the Li algebra of G shows up as an observable, or if it does. We were talking in the discussion beforehand about John Baez's recent paper, and I think maybe there's some connection there. I'd also like to know, and this is really for me the crucial question, can you extend the definition of a dynamical classical model in such a way that you replace the discrete measurement, the discrete outcome set E, with the entire apparatus of a Kolmogorovian model, so that your measurement can actually be something, something measure theoretic, something maybe something continuous. With that sort of extension, assuming you can make it, another question is the Bohm interpretation of quantum mechanics recognizable as some form of a suitably extended, in this sense, DCM. And now I better stop, so thank you. Here is an inadequate list of references that I won't give you time to read, and here is the recipe. So, okay, so I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And so I guess we have time for questions. So just raise your hand. Tom.
Okay. Yeah, so I had a question, which I'm afraid is about contextuality. So there was, yeah, because you just said, you know, was something you wanted to ask us about, possibly. So there's a recent paper by some people at PI, I think, Rob Speck and David Schmidt, John Selby, where they had this kind of simplex embeddability as this condition for the existence of a non-classical model. So you take a state space and an effect space, and if they can be embedded in the state spaces and effect spaces of a simplex, there's affine maps into them. And I was wondering if this was the same embedding as the classical embedding you defined at the start with the dispersion free.
I suspect not. And the reason is that the kind of embedding I was talking about embeds the measurement apparatus, you might say, the test space, in a sort of big classical Kolmogorovian test space, but it doesn't embed the probability weights. So basically the story is distinct outcomes of your measurement apparatus are interpreted as distinct events or maybe effects in the classical model, but I'm allowing for a single state of your system to be interpreted by many different probability measures in the classical case.
Okay.
I just want there to be at least one interpretation, but I'm allowing many. So it's injective on the measurement side, surjective on the state side. So I think it's a little different.
Yeah, that sounds different. Okay, yeah, thank you.
Of course, well, okay, so we could, there's a little tiny bit more to say about that, but somebody else I think had raised a hand.
Well, Alex, I think you just answered my question. So I was wondering, is the functor faithful?
I don't think so.
Right. So it is not possible to distinguish between two significantly different probabilistic theories from their classical extensions just by looking at their classical extensions.
Right. So to be clear, when you say they're classical extensions, you would have to mean, the sort of the images. Yeah, I think the answer I have to think about that for a minute. You would be able to tell the difference between the, okay, here's my question for you. When you talk about the image under the classical extension, do you just mean the particular Kolmogorovian model that you get?
Yes, that's what I was thinking about.
Okay. Because if you just have that, that's not enough. But if you know how the original model's test space is embedded in that Kolmogorovian test space, that of course tells you what the test space was. And now the question is, what can you say about the states? Well, I think you could recover those because you look at restrictions of probability measures you still couldn't. You look at restrictions of probability measures in the Kolmogorovian model to the particular events that are the images of your outcomes, and that will give you a bunch of probability weights, but you don't know which of those probability weights are the ones that were singled out as the state space. So yeah, the answer is no, you can't.
Okay, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Are there more questions? Lucien.
Hi. So the way I think about those probabilistic models nowadays is that you have some kind of sort of circuit structure or kind of causal structure living in the, and then you put the probability theory on top of that. So in some sense, that structure, that sort of circuit structure, which in some sense characterizes you know, how you put your experiment together comes first. And I'm wondering how the kind of approach you take sort of looks in that respect. Like, it seems that you almost take an opposite point of view, that you start with a very abstract characterization of probabilistic theories and then try to dig structure out of it. Is that right?
I think that's fair, but I think I would go back even a little bit a step further and say that for me the building blocks are these probabilistic models. And one can think of a probabilistic model, I suppose, as a description of like a single component in a circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And so then, you know, I guess the way I haven't really sat down to work this out, but the way I've sort of assumed that I would handle circuits when and if I get around to thinking about them seriously is as sort of templates for patterns of sequential and parallel compositions of individual probabilistic models. And there are ways of composing probabilistic models, both sequentially and in parallel. Actually, the sequential story is pretty interesting. That was going to be sort of the other talk that you guys didn't vote to hear. So there's some things to say there. But I think the approach is opposite only in the sense that rather than starting with the circuits and then sort of imposing the probabilistic structure on top of that, I'm more inclined to start with a probabilistic description of sort of components of circuits and then combine those into circuits. But I suspect that you end up at the same place, whichever route you take.
And then one thing that might happen is that, you know, I'm not quite sure how this plays out in what you describe, but, you know, operationally, if you describe, so you could describe an operational circuit. So this is just a circuit where the composition of the circuit describes what you can sort of do in a laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
But then there may be another circuit which describes some more fundamental level of causal structure, which has, you know, arrows in it, or wires in it that don't appear in the operational level. And so in the kind of stuff that you're doing where you find these classical theories, it might well be that those classical theories don't have the same causal structure. They have more wires or something like that going on. Does that seem likely?
That seems plausible to me. I'm speculating a little bit because I need to sit down and think carefully about what you're saying. But I think that the more structure you put on top of the sort of bare bones structure of probabilistic models that I described, the harder it is to preserve that structure when you try to build, you know, classical representations of whatever kind. So it's entirely plausible what you're saying. Okay. I would say it sounds entirely plausible.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
Okay. Are there more questions?
Maybe, yeah, there's time, just one final one. I was trying to think about this classical embedding again, and yeah, with this dispersion-free. So this, is it maybe more akin to kind of this Cohen-Specker contextuality, possibly, because it's about existence of like 0-1 valued?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so in fact, the Cohen-Specker, you know, if you go back and you look at the Cohen-Specker construction, the classic one, at any rate, actually starts with something that's very much like that triangle example I started with, except it's not a triangle, it's a pentagon. You've got five little experiments pasted together in a loop with three outcomes each. And yes. Yeah, you can make that connection.
Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Okay.
So I guess if we do not have more questions, we can thank Alex again for this nice talk.
Thank you.
And thank you. Okay. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for putting up with such a long talk. I'm sorry to keep everybody for so long. All right. So, all right. Well, thanks everybody. Take care.
Thank you.
I hope to see you in, you know, some less virtual way.